Hey, pleased to be checking back in with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy for another Tacky Talk. It's been a little while. How are you doing, Tacky?
It's been a little while, Joe. It's great to see you on this cloudy Wednesday morning.
I know. I didn't recognize you at first because of your new do.
Well, we spent a whole year together watching my hair grow for 6 months at a time between cuts. So I got a cut within 2 months for a change. And we've gone to a bit of a summer cut. But in 2 weeks, I promise to be shaggy again.
Okay, now that's good. Then I'll know who you are again. actually, a whole lot has happened since we last chatted at the state level. We were talking about it before we started interviewing this morning. Sports betting, the budget, of course, the Delta variant is now making news here in Massachusetts, and there's been some changes for voting.
Yeah, it's been a very busy month in July. And actually, we do have a phone session today. Again, we're doing it by remote on the phone. So, you know, literally, you guys are getting me right before I go into a session at home. But no, it's been very busy. And mail-in voting has been a real priority for folks, especially with municipal elections coming up, especially those with preliminary elections coming in September, to have a go at it. And mail-in voting, by all accounts, has been very successful in Massachusetts. There has been very little problems in implementing it for the first time. Having done a second time, I should go very smoothly since, for lack of a better term, to get the kinks out the first time. And we were able to agree on allowing continuation of the current mail-in voting process to the end of 2020.
2021.
We're 2021. Yes, time is still all the same in my brain. I know, to the end of this year in 2021. So yeah, we are going to allow mail-in voting, and we'll reevaluate the issue as we go into the winter months.
Okay.
Prior to the town elections, for those who are from towns, knows their town elections occur in the springtime. So, you know, we'll see how the fall elections go to reevaluate. But this has huge implications for Quincy elections. There's a preliminary nomination papers we do yesterday's in Quincy. You know, Boston obviously has a very active mayor's race with a big preliminary. Lynn has a big race going on as well as all the down ticket races with the city councils and the school committees in different cities. So while I know there is no mayor's race in Quincy this year, you know, it will impact at least the school committee race, which does appear to have a preliminary. I believe there's seven candidates, need to get down to six. And obviously there's going to be at least five candidates running for a large that will be in the final election in November. And I believe there's going to be races in Ward 1 and Ward 2. And so it will impact those locations.
Does that mean the state is going to pay for mail-in voting again?
I think that's a topic that's going to be discussed as we go along. Right now, we're not planning to pay for this election. It is a local election, not a state and federal election. So it was a very logical course for us to pick up those costs, especially when it was, quite frankly, sprung on season clerks suddenly, for lack of a better term. I mean, it was pandemic. None of us knew what was really going on. We had suspended all the Roosevelt Town meeting elections in the spring very quickly last year, and actually delayed town meetings, as well as delayed local town elections last year. We actually authorized emergency delay for many small towns, which they had to push their elections into September. Whether we're trying to try to do a mail-in ballot at the same time. So it was, I'll be honest, it was complete chaos. Unfortunately, we live in Quincy, so we don't have to deal with spring elections, but the majority of communities in the state have spring elections. So you can all figure out, if you didn't have your election in early March and you were having an election in April, COVID pandemic one was crazed. And I know places like, you know, Dedham was trying to have an election, you know, in the April period, and nobody knew what was going on. So, I mean, I know that, like, my friend from Saugus and my friend Donna Wong, who's a rep from Saugus, had their election delayed a little bit of time while they're waiting for a mail-in ballots and state guidance about how to handle these type of small town elections. So, you know, living in Quincy, you know, we don't have to deal with these things, but, you know, obviously I don't represent a town, but at the same time, though, you know, I do have to think about this stuff as a member of the legislature.
Well, you're voting on it, so yeah.
Yeah, and also the concerns of my colleagues who do represent this community. So I think people kind of forget that I don't like just niche in, oh, it's a Quincy only issue. I don't have to worry about it. It doesn't affect me. Well, that's not true.
Yeah.
You know, I do have to take into consideration my colleagues' issues around me on their local things that we don't have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And vice versa, right?
Oh, absolutely. They do think about things that impact the city and, you know, take consideration of whether they're going to vote for something and not because it doesn't affect them, but because it affects somebody else. So,
right.
You know, this is kind of one of the part of the jobs that I think people don't really consider because they think I just worry about this little part of Quincy and I don't think about the rest of the world. That's not true. And mail-in ballots is one of those examples as we had to learn about, well, what's going on somewhere else and what can we do to help them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think it'll become permanent in the future, Tacky?
I think at some point it will. I think people really do like this expansion of the ability to vote. Our lives are busy. I don't know how else to put this to people. I mean, you know, people are having more than one job. Pandemic clearly showed how many people in the workforce work all kinds of hours. You know, essential employees, you know, people even, you know, with remote learning at home, and some families are still struggling about whether to go to a hybrid model or send their kids to school. I mean, there's still a lot of, you know, discussions in people's homes about what do they want to do down the road. Mail-in voting has shown that in an increasingly busy world, you know, voting access becomes more important.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, sure. And obviously when there is a health crisis, safety is an issue too. And also here in New England, weather can be an issue, particularly in November elections.
Absolutely. I mean, you and I have seen some 70 degree a day weather and still see a remarkably low turnout.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So, you know, and I've campaigned in the Martha Coakley winter election, which I keep repeating to everybody, I'm never running a winter campaign again. But I remember that January on the final election against Scott Brown, it was a light snow in Eastern Mass, which means in Western Mass, it was snowing a little more than it was on the east side. I mean, there's all those other factors. And I mean, but also those people plan their lives a little better through mail-in ballots. So you can, if you want to have that medical procedure, you don't want to deal with trying to figure out an absentee ballot, you want to, you know, vote early or mail-in ballot. You're planning that trip, you have that, you know, sudden change in emergency plans, at least you got your ballot in early, so you don't have to worry about it. I mean, it creates a lot of options for folks, specifically of unforeseen situations, you point out. It doesn't have to be a pandemic, but if you get your mail-in ballot and you suddenly find yourself in a medical crisis or a family crisis around election day period, at least you know you voted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think it'll ever progress to online voting?
This was actually tried in the state of Oregon.
Oh.
I know tacky trivia comes up. And
that's why I love talking to you, Tacky, because I learn all new kinds of new stuff every time.
Yeah, they did that about a dozen years ago or more, and it needs work.
Okay, yeah. Well, it's safety and hacking would be my major concern. I'm sure it's theirs too.
Yeah, they have. It was very primitive technology compared to now. I'm trying to remember which European country, but there is a European country that does do electronic everything.
Hmm.
They do encrypted identification, which means that you have a government identification that's encrypted, that has a reader when you go. They'll give you a reader, and then it has to read it. Now, it accesses everything. You can file your taxes with it. You can do, like, all your government services with this one encrypted code, including voting.
Hmm. Interesting.
I cannot remember the country off the top of my head right now, but
yeah.
It's actually a very small country. I think it's a very small country.
Liechtenstein or something. You know?
Yeah, it's less than the population of Massachusetts.
Oh, all right. Okay.
I mean, they decided to do a uniform, secure, encrypted system where, you know, you can file your taxes online. You can pay your bills online. You can check your government resource online. If you're on government health care, you can check all your stuff there. It's a single portal system. They spent a lot of money on.
Mm-hmm.
But the key part is that you have an encrypted code on your government identification card that with a specific reader that allows you to access the system. And you're right. Cybersecurity is actually a huge issue for them. So that, you know, so if we're going to go the direction on online voting, the investment in technology is going to be enormous. And with this country, next time I will find the country and tell you what it is.
Okay.
Did a major investment because they decided to uniform their entire government programs into one system.
Interesting. Okay. Something else that's changed since last we chatted, sports betting has been approved.
Yeah, round two for sports betting.
Yeah.
We did this late last fall, and we're back again to do another bill, which is actually not that different from the one we passed before. There are some changes, but mostly the same. I mean, it creates three types of licenses, one for casinos, one for essentially racetracks/simulcasting parlors, racetracks, and then mobile betting.
Oh, really? I didn't know about the mobile betting part. Okay.
Yeah, it's a third type of license. And then the taxation structure, which isn't a tax structure, because that's not an accurate term. It's really a takeout. So, you know, every dollar wagered, the state will take 12.5% or $12.5.
Okay.
Every live bet in person, and 15 cents on the dollar for every mobile bet.
Okay.
So the state will take that as of each wager. That's why it's really not a tax. It's a takeout structure. It takes out of the wager, hence yeah. Takeout.
Well, it's a tax on the people who are gambling, basically.
Yeah, essentially. And then, what the remainder goes into the operator. And then we still can tax the operator again as a business tax. Oh,
okay.
So it's a weird, it's every wager is almost a dual tax system. You get money taken out in front, and then we still tax the business itself at the other end.
Yep.
But since it's wagering, they can't raise the prices on it.
Gotcha. Okay.
And your bet is your bet.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So they can't basically pass the cost on to the gambler. They have to absorb that.
They absorb that. And, you know, given the volume of wagering that can occur, that, you know, the numbers could get pretty crazy.
Yeah.
I do think the state's numbers are probably a little low at $60 million in profit for us.
Wow.
But I think that may be low once we go to full blown, because it's not just professional, but it includes collegiate.
Yes.
And it has a very broad definition of professional sports.
Okay.
So basically any two people competing for something that is in a professional level could be wagered on, which, you know, you can make an argument that, you know, video game competition, for example, which is becoming a big thing globally.
Yeah.
It could be considered a wagered item.
Okay.
If it's done at a professional level, these guys get paid to do this for a living professionally.
Yep. Yep, yep. Beach volleyball or something.
You're right. Another example of that would be, let me think here, professional eating contest.
Oh, okay. I don't know if I'd bet on that, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, you can't bet on like how many hot dogs you can consume, but you can bet strictly on who's going to win.
Okay, I get you.
So you can't play those things in Vegas where, you know, you can bet on someone taking penalties, for example.
Okay, all right. How does the mobile work? Is there an app that's going to happen, or how does that work?
They're already out there. I mean, you already see the FanDuel's and, you know, all the other fantasy sports apps. So it's not going to be a huge leap
for
betting. We just want to be sure that, you know, they have a similar program like they do in other states where it's all IP address driven. They have identification and verification of persons' accounts. You know, all the other safeguards you have regarding mobile type.
Yeah, PC. Yeah. How do you guarantee that minors won't use it?
Well, there is no absolute guarantee. The best we can do is to require proper identification and, you know, tie the IP addresses to inside the state.
Okay.
And, that's the best we can do. It's like the whole thing about alcohol delivery. It's the same problem.
Yeah.
So it's only so much controls we can have. We have to rely on the operators that have the licenses at risk to put all the proper safeguards in, or they're going to lose the license.
Okay.
And standard review for mobile betting and in live sports betting is the same review process as getting a casino license. And the fee to get a license is $5 million.
Ooh. Now, does the revenue funnel to any specific area?
The fees go back to pay for its own regulation.
Okay.
So it's not a taxpayer driven regulatory industry. The operators would have to actually pay the gaming commission to regulate. The money collected from the 12.5 cents and 15 cents each dollar wager we collect actually funnels into a specific location. So we have a huge workforce development trust fund. That is what it sounds like. It is designed to try to help people transition to the modern economy and people take advantage of opportunities. Mm-hmm. So 40% goes in there. 33% goes into local aid. So the cities and towns would be happy to hear about that. More mm-hmm. money from the state, you can do what you want with. About 20% of that goes to a youth assistance program for scholarships and youth at risk. We have about 6% goes to public health trust fund. And people think, well, why 6%? Well, if you look at the casino gaming side, they got a lot more over there than the other funds. Mm-hmm. And we have a whole lot of healthcare COVID money right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the public health trust fund is actually pretty flush. And then we have 1% going to this very peculiar player benevolent fund, and allows the professional sports teams to advise on this 1% of the money going to various charitable organizations.
Okay. All right. Is this modeled after any other states that are already doing this? I know many of our neighboring states already have it in place.
Yeah, it's not too different from Rhode Island or Connecticut or New Jersey or other states. It's all relatively the same in principle. The major difference is really the regulatory structures.
Hmm.
So our bill mimics our own casino gaming law already in terms of review processes, which mimics, oddly enough, places like New Jersey. So there's a relatively uniform, I'm not saying 100%, but I mean relatively similar process in all states regarding gambling review. So you're not going to find like major deviations. Like, for example, controlling interest, you know, we want to know who the controlling interest in the business is. Every state wants to know the controlling interest in the business.
Sure, yeah.
So there isn't major variations in the sense. There may be some nuances specifically to your state, but in terms of like overall application of the process, it's relatively similar.
Yeah. And think the governor's going to sign it, or did he sign it yet?
Well, it's sitting in the Senate. Like last time out, you know, we got it out of the House and it was sitting in the Senate. I talked to a couple of friends over in the Senate, and, you know, they are still having a very active discussion trying to determine, you know, what is the compromise position of the Senate among the senators themselves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, it is an active conversation.
Okay.
Going over there. And the House, you know, feels that there is a good chance that the senators will reach an agreement among themselves that will result in the bill going to us in the conference committee.
Okay.
So at this stage of the game, when people want to have sports betting, you shouldn't be too concerned about what's in the Senate bill, just as long as the Senate bill coming out.
Gotcha.
The conference committee will resolve the differences.
Okay, very good. Any more talk about the millionaire tax recently on Beacon Hill?
No, it's going on the ballot in 2022. So at this point, there's really no conversation to be had. The voters will have a chance in November 2022 to vote for on the Constitution. It's a constitutional change, everyone. So this is a much more difficult to do than passing a ballot initiative law to create a two-tiered system tax. Massachusetts is a flat tax system that you get people in the same class, same category, which Supreme Court has ruled many times what different categories of people are, pay the same tax rate. This constitutional change is required if you want to have income tax rate to be tiered. And that you would add 4% to the people who make every dollar over $1 million to be taxed at a higher rate. So, and the money would be dedicated to transportation and education programs. So people can make that decision next November.
All right. Stay tuned for that, for sure. Looking forward. Sales tax holiday? it just kind of like it exploded and died.
Yeah, you notice how the governor dropped that little bomb on us because it was upset about our COVID, not giving him COVID money. And
yeah, we can talk about that too, but yeah.
Yeah. So still August the 14th and 15th.
Okay.
You know, if like last year, people don't want to feel like being crowded in the store, you know, definitely go online and pre-order and schedule for pickup. I did that last time during COVID. You know, I didn't order a lot, but I ordered a couple of things and scheduled for pickup or delivery.
Okay.
Myself. So people are feeling a little hesitant about, you know, this massive crush of people on that weekend. I do advise that, you know, get up that morning on the 14th and 15th and find a local business you can order online.
There you go. But the month-long thing, not so much.
Two-month-long thing.
Oh, so that's right. It was 2 months.
2 months.
That's right.
Yeah, that's not happening.
Well, he was probably hoping he could negotiate down to 1 month.
That's not happening.
Okay.
not a lot of desire anywhere to actually go into 2 months.
Okay. Since we're talking about money, we have a state budget now.
We do indeed have a state budget. The state budget is somewhat larger than we originally voted for back in April, reflecting the increased revenue projections that we have as a result of stronger revenues than we ever thought we would, because driven by capital gains. We were able to at least shore up a lot of our programs, you know, once again, put money into the rainy day fund, preparing ourselves on COVID cost.
Yep.
And weathering, hopefully not an economic downturn, by shoring up the rainy day fund and other types of trust funds for programs. So, the city did very well. I mean, we got a record number on education Chapter 70 funds because of our Educator Reform Act. We're able to get pretty much a very high number on local aid because the lottery has been the strongest since pre-pandemic. Mm. Massive lottery recovery, as well as general tax revenues that we put into local aid as well. So the city, not that I can make remember the numbers off to my head, which I'm going to cheat now, as you guys are looking down at my phone.
That's all right. We want accuracy. We don't mind if you remember it or not. We just want accuracy.
Well, me being accurate is always a question mark. But
well, approximate then.
Yeah, it's about $52 million in local aid to the city of Quincy. I mean, $31.8 million for education and $20.9 million, give or take a few thousand. For the local aid city of Quincy can spend how it wants. And the city budget, I believe, is like $345 million.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, about $52 million of that is direct state aid. It doesn't include things like school meals, doesn't include the library assistance, doesn't include the senior center assistance, doesn't include all this other government money that we provide to cities and towns. This is just strictly two forms of assistance that mm-hmm. we do. So, I mean, that represents $52 million plus out of the $340 million budget is pretty substantial.
Yep.
You know, obviously we got some local monies, right? We got money to Amanda Community Health Center. We got money to Bridget Resources, Gerrantown Neighborhood Center. Down in the Speaker's District, he got money for the Parks and Park improvements and Ward 2 Civic Associations. We got overtime patrols again for Quinshaw Drive and Furnish Brook Parkway. That's large thanks to Bruce doing that hard work on that front. So, I mean, the city, made up pretty well on top of local aid, on top of the regular monies we get, and, beyond the other grant programs the city applies for. Despite a lack of knowledge about what the financial future holds, we've done extremely well. And, let's be honest about it. Speaker Mariano, we should be doing okay for a while.
Yeah, I guess they have some influence up there with what Quincy gets. And probably Weymouth, too, because part of his district is in Weymouth.
No, absolutely. And at Holbrook.
Oh, right. So, of course. Yep.
So you talk about town politics, right? So, yeah. I mean, let's not pretend it isn't there. I mean, Speaker Mariano is still Speaker Mariano.
Speaking of, any change in rules for opening the State House? Or talk about that, Jackie.
Yeah, we had passed House rules this month as well. We're operating under temporary rules to July 15th.
Yeah.
The new rules have been finalized and will be effective October 1st, where we end temporary rules. For people wondering what rules are, it's basically the operations of the House. So we operate the internal function of the House through House rules. So it ranges from everything from a dress code in the chamber, to the human resource director assignment and all the procedural stuff in the middle, regarding how you operate a session. So, and also formation of House only committees, the so-called standing committees. People who went to school know these things are standing committees. So that people took politics classes like me, you have the joint committees and standing committees, So the House committees, we refer to as, committees that stand on their own. So like Ways and Means is a standing committee, right?
Okay. Finance Committee for City Council, same kind of thing.
Same kind of idea, right? So, whatever the House rules govern on operating of House committees is in the House rules. So one of the major changes this year, actually two major changes. The other ones are kind of more keeping up the times changes. But the two major ones is one, to allow, to require House committees to publish their votes on the website in aggregate, meaning that you have, 22 votes in favor, and then, you have four people against, for example. You know, very, very simple aggregate counts.
Oh, instead of a breakdown individually, you mean?
Yeah, it's basically a box. It's a basically a final score, not a box. Box score, just a final score. And then the other change we made is we allowed a procedure to create emergency rules. Last session, we didn't have a procedure to create emergency rules, so we had to create emergency rules on the fly.
Right.
So now we actually will have a formal process in the House rules to create emergency rules in case of another state of emergency. It's very broadly written what the state of emergency is, because if it's, a snowstorm is one thing.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need to do emergency rules. But, if there's another pandemic, or if there's a terrorist attack, or a devastating weather event,
mm-hmm.
Like a Katrina-type situation, the House has the ability to create emergency rules to redo the House operations, quickly.
Okay.
Last year, there was a lot of discussion among leadership and members about what emergency rules should look like during a pandemic, because we didn't know how long, what was going on, what did we have to work with, and that took quite a bit of time and conversation to make something fit into our constitutional requirements of functionality.
Right. Yeah, obviously the pandemic forced a lot of changes in a lot of different ways, and it's still doing it today now with this most recent surge throughout the states. It's concerning, I'm sure.
Oh, it's extremely concerning. The Delta variant is 1,000 times more virulent than the original one in terms of, it's equal death ability, but in terms of its kill rate, for lack of a better term.
Mm.
But it does have a 1,000 times more contagiousness than the original COVID from, it feels like a lifetime ago.
It's true.
You'd
long for the days of the original COVID?
Yeah, I know. It sounds awful when you put it that way, doesn't it? You wish you had the one we actually know something about now.
Exactly, yeah.
And it's considered to be well over 50% more transmissible than the British Alpha variant. So in case you're all wondering, the dominant strain in the U.S. is the British Alpha variant. And in recent months, the new dominant strain is now the Delta variant.
Right.
So you guys are probably wondering, how about the Beta and Epsilon and all those other letters? The answer is that those strains had not been nearly as robust in contagiousness as Alpha and Delta. Like, there's a California variant everyone forgot about already.
Mm-hmm.
That was very, I think, mid last summer, Alpha variant in California made an appearance, but didn't have the transmissibility power as Alpha. And now there's a new one, Lambda, coming out of Peru. Again, it's very powerful, but not nearly as transmissible as Delta. And you're kind of thinking, well, why is that? Well, each variant appears in different parts of the world. It's all tied to vaccination rates, as people now come to realize that low vaccination rate causes more transmission, which causes more opportunity for mutation.
Mm-hmm.
So vaccination rates prevent spread, which prevents mutations, which prevents more dangerous versions of the virus.
It's quite literally a catch-22. It's a vicious cycle, that won't be broken unless the vaccination rates reach a certain point.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. Not every variation makes it more dangerous. It just means it's changed. Its ability to injure you is equal, mm-hmm. as the original SARS. It's that its ability to move through a population is faster,
mm-hmm.
a lot faster than the original SARS. I'm saying SARS, COVID. It's a SARS. It's SARS. COVID.
It's a version of SARS. Right. Exactly. You're not wrong. Yeah.
Yes. SARS-2 and all the other letters.
Correct. Yeah.
But it's a lot more dangerous because of the speed of transmission and the ability that it odds of you being exposed to the virus, odds go up that you can become infected.
Mm-hmm.
This was kind of the whole my talk last spring was the whole, hey, we don't know how it's very infectious, you know, you're around someone, you know, the odds of catching it are, you know, 1.5 to one person. There's, you know, these are your odds now. I mean, now it's been magnified 1,000-fold that the length of time you just spend with an infected person it doesn't have to be nearly as long as the original version of COVID.
Yeah, or the 6-foot distance either, I don't think is as much applicable this time around.
It may not be, because, you know, the longer someone's breathing on you, for lack of a better term, we're breathing within breathing distance of each other more accurately as well. You know, your odds start to improve that you can catch the infection.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that makes Delta very scary. And, you know, 99.9% or 99% or whatever, you know, high 90s percentage, depending on which news report you read.
Right.
I mean, I've seen 97, 99. I mean, it all changes. But, I mean, they're all predominantly people who have never been vaccinated.
Right. Yep.
And the death rate right now on the Delta variant is super predominantly on people who are not vaccinated.
Yeah, and as I heard one doctor explained, the way the situation is right now, it's, you know, either you're going to get vaccinated or you're going to get the Delta variant. Those are your options.
Yeah, and again, I remind folks, you know, people always talk, oh, it's a 2%-ish, you know, death rate from COVID. Well, yeah, but you ignore the serious hospitalization rate of well over 10-15%. So people, you know, are playing the odds on not dying. Okay, you know, we just talk about sports betting, right?
Yeah.
You know, people want to play the odds against not getting, you know, seriously ill.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that if you become one of 10 or one of 15, whatever, 10 or 15% of people who become seriously ill, you know, we have the hospital system overrun. Again, Essex County during the most recent wave went over 100% capacity. The whole county ran out of hospital beds. You know, Social Hospital had long periods where they were overrun. Boston hospitals proper Boston area, you know, was sitting at 94 to 96% potential overrun.
Mm-hmm.
ICU beds at 90% capacity. People were at the DCU center. Okay, it wasn't like people were not using the Worcester DCU center. People were there. So, you know, the idea is that if you don't get the Delta variant, you don't get COVID-19, you ensure the hospital system is not overrun. So, you know, Lord forbid that you have a family member that has cancer, has a heart attack, has a stroke, has a car accident, you know, whatever, unforeseen or a comorbidity that you may have that you need regular treatment for, is able to access the hospital.
Right.
You know, that is the thing I keep trying to remind folks. That's why these vaccines are so important. It assures that you have a lower probability of finding yourself in a hospital because of COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody else who actually needs hospital services is able to get their hospital services.
Right, because if they can't, I mean, really, if they can't and they die, you can really attribute that to the pandemic. And indirectly.
And you get greater exposure. Everybody doesn't like going to hospital because there's sick people. Like, of course, it's a hospital, right? But I mean, imagine now you got this very highly transmissible Delta variant in the hospital. You have a serious health issue. You can name any health issue. And now you're in a hospital, even though it's segregated, because they do segregate the
mm-hmm.
the COVID and non-COVID section of the hospital. But you have a much higher transmission ability. And now you're inside a city. Generally, you're in the city that has a high transmission rate. You know, try and get to the hospital for a non-COVID related illness. Now you just added higher risk to those individuals needing that hospital access by yourself being infected.
Correct. Yeah.
This is simple. I don't understand why this is so difficult for people to grasp sometimes.
It's unfortunate it's been so politicized. And I don't know the answer. You know, I've seen some interviews where folks are hesitant because they say it was developed too quickly. They don't trust the science. They don't trust the government. They think the government's behind it.
Well, somebody is like everything else in life. Somebody was, look, of all the people in my life, you know, doing this business, everyone suddenly is an expert in politics. You know, yes. I've only been doing this my entire adult life, folks. I mean, not as long as Michael Morris. He's been doing this even longer than most people's adult lives. But, but now everyone's a medical expert, right? And this is kind of an interesting human phenomenon. And I live with it the most because I'm in an occupation where everybody's an expert, right? So I'm just kind of used to it. But when it comes to medical stuff, no, everybody's not an expert. And, you know, we have a solution. It's called vaccination. And, you know, it's up to us to take care of each other. And it's kind of a funny phenomenon. People wouldn't think twice about, you know, running onto a street if someone was hit by a car in an accident. Although, you know, people have the cell phones, you know, use the 911 function, folks, before you put on a video. I mean, just saying.
Right.
But people don't hesitate to, you know, jump out to help folks. But you get to this situation, it's not the same type of mentality. And people will run into traffic to save somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but not not this type of scenario. It's it's just how people are. I mean, I just can't tell you why. It's just where people are.
Yeah. There is no explaining it. That's right. It's going to be interesting to see if one of the vaccines, I think Pfizer is supplied to be approved for folks 12 and under. So that will change things.
I do expect one of the vaccines to be approved 12 and under sometime this fall. I really do. I heard there's a bit of a setback for this week in the news because they didn't get a big enough sample of kids in their study. So FDA's and CDC sent them back saying, you know, get a bigger sample and come back. So I thought they'd be ready by post Labor Day, but it looks like it'd be delayed a little bit because the FDA wants a bigger sample. But overall, vaccination rates up here are pretty good. I was looking the other day on vaccination rates, and the top five states, we take out the U.S. territories, the top five states that are highest vaccination rates is Vermont, followed by Massachusetts.
Hmm. Okay.
And then the other remaining states are Maine, Vermont, and Connecticut are the five highest vaccinated states in the country. New Hampshire comes in eighth.
Okay, so in the top 10 still right here in the Northeast.
Yeah, and all of us are well over 60% vaccinated people. I mean, the number's a little weird because initially the number is based on people over age 18. Now it's everyone above age 12.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody over age 12, there's well over 60% vaccination, which means everybody over 18 has got to be closer to the 70% zone.
Right.
So if you just take that above 18 group, it's about closing on 70%. So, you know, geographically speaking, you know, this area has very strong vaccination rates. And, you know, I do believe that's going to continue forward. I know vaccination is slowing down, so we still need to encourage people to vaccinate. But, I mean, that is a good indicator, how we're doing in this region. So we're doing better than most countries, and we're clearly doing much better than our neighbors in the Deep South.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Quincy, I checked last week, the rate is, I think, over 66% in the city of Quincy itself. So it's doing very well also.
Yeah, absolutely. It's doing very well. And you got like over 90% vaccination rate for the senior population.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge, again, is the younger end of the bracket. You got that, not just teenagers, but people in their 20s and 30s, especially in the 20s, need to get vaccinated. And that's a little bit slower. And this, unfortunately, not the entire state isn't equal vaccination. Quincy's doing well in the 60s, but you get to places like, you know, Lawrence, which are trying to get to 50, and you see Boston, who just barely got to 60.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, system challenges in some of the rural areas in Western Mass are a little slow, but they're getting there. And thus, you know, not surprising, contained areas like the islands, you know, have a very high vaccination rate. You know, Montevision and Nantasket, Nantucket, they're both have high vaccination because they're a contained place. And Cape Cod, despite what you see in Provincetown, Cape Cod has a strong vaccination rate because senior population plus tourism is crucial. So having your workers vaccinated is essential.
Absolutely, yeah. So we're definitely not out of this, yet, unfortunately.
Well, we'll see. I mean, the state I was opening is actually now gonna be somewhat dependent on the Delta variant. Again, I remind folks, you know, if your office is basically your closet, welcome to the state house. That is the level of ventilation and no window access that some of these offices have. And some offices are literally just a plywood box of like a 10 by 10 square. Went in an extra chair. So it isn't like the glamour of Congress, folks. Believe me. I've had a fun office where my first office was basically everyone walking past me because I was in the middle of everybody else.
In the hallway office.
And it basically sums it up. I mean, it wasn't like a door or not really great partitions, right? All in the middle of the action. So, you know, my staff, you know, and I, are, you know, we all sit very close together in a small contained space with no HAVAC system. I mean, we don't have an HAVAC system. It's still blowing fans off of water pipes.
Right. Yep. Yeah. It's primitive, to say the least. Yeah.
Yeah. Not circulatory system whatsoever. So, I mean, this, you get to the middle part of the building, it gets worse. So with this Delta variant, we don't know who's coming and going. We opened the building up to the public. It is a historical building, and a tourist site and a museum. So it is not just State House employees. It's not just people doing the State House, but probably half the building would be just people walking in the door, mostly tourists and sometimes students. And it's not like other places. People think, oh, you can just limit it to employees. Like you go to one Ashburn place, it's people, there's the public employees and people doing business there. And most of it can be done online now. So you can actually, you know, try to get more stuff on the internet to create a reduced number of foot traffic of people coming in.
Yep.
State House isn't like that.
You know, and you don't know, people's vaccination status, and you can't ask. So there's the issue.
Yeah, and the Delta variant really is scary. When I tell you guys that, you know, we're working in basic closets, no ventilation. The Delta variant is very scary because you're right. We don't know who comes in. We don't know the vaccine. We don't know what's going on.
Yeah. Reach out to you, Techie, of course.
617-722-2014, 617-722-201. Mash a button and leave a voicemail of anybody. I was still working remotely. Hopefully we'll be back in the fall in some hybrid, maybe format, more conversations to come.
Okay.
You can email me at tacky.chan@mahouse.gov. tacky.chan@mahouse.gov. I am now taking a whole ton of testimony from people. We're already into, I think, hearing like 9 in the committee so far.
Wow. Okay.
It's I'm losing count. You can actually watch my hearings at State Representative Tacky Chan Facebook. It's on Facebook Live. You like miss seeing me here. You can see me there. We put up some useful information and some activities I've been involved in. And now we're streaming our public hearings on there during this virtual period we're still living in. And, tackychan.org, we put up useful information on there as well. You can search that website for stuff before calling my office and maybe save me some time.
Okay. Sounds good. Really nice to see you. And we'll see how long your hair grows next time.
Well, we could start that game again that we did all through COVID about Tacky hair growth, where it was filling up half the screen.
Tacky in the 70s, right? The 70s do. all right. Thanks a lot, Tacky. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. Talk to you soon.